This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Marilynne Robinson is one of the most admired fiction writers in America. In particular, she's known for her depiction of Midwestern life and, more unusual, spiritual life. Robinson grew up in Idaho, but long ago relocated to Iowa, and the landscape there, the history there, made quite an impression on her and her imagination.
When I went to Iowa, where I went because of the writer's program there, I noticed that the landscape had a very high number of little colleges scattered over it, and big colleges and significant colleges, you know. Often the oldest structures in any community is the college, which is a very extraordinary thing. Places like Grinnell, you know. And so I wanted to know who had built these things, that this was how you would settle an empty landscape. And that was when I came across the abolitionist movement. Those were the people who did this. And they, you know, they felt, as people often say, that, you know, knowledge is power, that knowledge is freedom, that, you know, in order to create a culture in which slavery could not be introduced or could not flourish, one major antidote would be education.
As she thought about that history, Robinson imagined and brought to life an Iowa town called Gilead. That became the title of her 2004 novel, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Gilead is narrated by an aging preacher named John Ames. And at the heart of the book is a profound question. How should Christians respond to our country's legacy of racial oppression? More books set in the world of Gilead followed. Home, Lila, and now a fourth book called Jack. Jack is Jack Boughton, the son of John Ames's closest friend.
One of the reasons that I have written the books that followed Gilead is because, you know, I have to focus when I write a novel, and I really do, I realize that. But there are all these peripheral characters, you know. They are strong presences in my imagination that have seemed to me, one after another, to deserve his or her own novel. Jack was especially present to my mind. I mean, he's, I think, my most recurring character, even before the book.
And he's a scoundrel. He's a prodigal son who's always getting into trouble. Were you setting out to redeem him in some way in this novel?
Well, you know, I have always felt that there is a fundamental innocence in Jack, that he, the world is from our perspective, strange to him in a way that he continuously tests. And one of the things that he does is sort of test himself against his father's anxieties and hopes and nurturing and all the rest of it, you know. He's, as I see him, alienated from experience itself, really.
He's a recurring character, but this novel is set in St. Louis, not in Iowa, and it's a love story. Jack falls in love with a black woman named Della Miles, and there's this wonderful extended scene in the book where they come across each other accidentally in a cemetery. It's early in their courtship. They hardly know each other. Could you read a passage from that scene?
Yes. There she was in the cemetery of all places, and at night and ready to be a little glad to see him. I am the Prince of Darkness. He couldn't say that. It was a joke he made to himself. He would walk down to where she was in the lamplight. No. Any policeman who came might take it into his head to say the word solicitation, since he was disreputable and she was black. Since they were together at night in the cemetery, better to keep his distance. And he knew he always looked better from a distance, even a little gentlemanly. He had his jacket on. His tie was in his pocket. He said, "You really shouldn't be here." A ridiculous thing to say, since there she was. Then, as if by way of explanation, "There are some pretty strange people here at night." When there he was, among the tombstones himself, taking a little comfort from the fact that she could not see him well, to notice the difference between whatever she thought of him in her moment of apparent relief and how he actually was.
Now, this is just a little bit of a scene that really extends over the first quarter of the book. Does something like that come to you fully born in the imagination? How does it arrive, and then how has it worked?
Well, you know, I knew that Jack was going to be in St. Louis. And so a friend of mine and I went to St. Louis to sort of get the lay of the land. Mm-hmm. And there's a spectacular old cemetery there, Bellefontaine. And we walked around in it, and it was just mortuary Disneyland or something. I mean, these just villages of tombs and forests I'm forgetting my own word, obelisks and so on, you know, and beautiful trees, spectacular old overgrown trees, and a lake or a very large pond. And it was having been there that made me feel that I could make good use of that cemetery.
The story takes place in Missouri in the 50s, when anti-miscegenation laws still very much existed. We're obviously in the middle of a reckoning on race in this country, and one could say it's a reckoning that's a very, very long time in coming, and we don't know exactly where it's going. But do you write with a political purpose when you're writing fiction?
I think it would depend on the definition of political, you know. I mean, when you look at Moby Dick, for example, there's a lyrical exaltation of the figure of the sailor, who in fact would have been a despised figure in the time that Melville wrote, you know. And, you know, I suppose some people would call that political. But I think if it's your politics, you would say, no, that's not political. You know, that's visionary and true, you know.
I'm sure you've noticed and appreciated that many of your readers who are themselves secular find that your books, which are so deeply attached to and concerned with faith and Christianity, these books really resonate with them. Have you thought about why that is?
Well, I think for one thing, you know, that there is a sort of, you know, there is religion itself, you know, the idea that the very, you know, apparently universal idea among people, you know, 100 years ago at any rate, that, you know, there's a sacredness in being, that the origins of being are themselves divine, that human beings have an extraordinary position among created things, you know, that what they do and what they suffer, those things are very meaningful, you know. At one point, I don't think it's terribly difficult to read much within the traditions of Orthodox Christianity at the same time that you are writing non-exclusively in a way that could be acknowledged by non-Christian faith, you know?
5 years ago, you wrote an essay called Fear, which is mm-hmm. about Christianity in America today. And you talked about Christianity as more, particularly in this country, as more and more becoming associated with ignorance, intolerance, and belligerent nationalism. And what are your concerns about that?
Well, I think that anyone really, not anyone, what can I say? There are legitimate grounds for concern. about whether or not the actual burden of Christian thought is being perpetuated, whether it is being consulted even, you know. I think part of the reason that we're in such trouble is because, you know, Tocqueville said that we were great because we were religious, basically, you know, and when the religion goes bad, you know, when the salt has really lost its savor, then we are really in trouble.
This is a conversation that you had with, among other people, with Barack Obama, not long after the publication of that essay, which was published in the New York Review of Books. Now, one thing that Obama has said about you and your writing is that he feels that you share a certain sense of hopefulness about this country, about American values. I have to ask, are you reading the same newspapers that I am? Because this is a rough time. I don't mean to be flip about it.
No. It has to be said, you know. There are elements in this country who seem to be very highly motivated, who seem to have a very highly articulated notion of what is to be desired, who are completely cryptic from my point of view. I mean, there's energy behind a kind of change that systematically demolishes democratic conventions and, you know, and toward what goal? Toward what is their horizon, you know? I think if this were by any means a normal political movement, we would know what they want. What do you do after you've basically, you know, destroyed the credibility of the CDC? You know, what do you do when you have depopulated major government agencies and filled them with people that, you know, that have no qualifications and no obvious good sense, you know? I mean, it's as if they had taken mannequins into the government and replaced the people that had been there previously, you know? And, you know, whose benefit? Where is this going?
Marilynne Robinson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marilynne Robinson, her new novel is called Jack.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.